24th. Why, that's tomorrow!
By the pricking of my thumb, something wicked this way comes.
And Dan, look! A key from Oz!
They have discovered the yellow brick road and are on their way to the Emerald City.
Every country in the world has witches. And there is a leader, a high witch of each country.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
When we first started talking about the theme of this show, I wanted to call it Scaring the Hell Out of Kids.
Yeah.
Because it's a phenomenon that it's kind of fallen out of fashion. When you look back at the films that were presumably made for children, or even pre-Disney-fied Grimm's fairy tales, there's a darkness you don't often see anymore. Grimm's fairy tales, or children's and household tales, was first published in 1812, and it saw a similar arc. The first volumes were criticized for being too dark, too violent, and often too sexual. We saw a similar pattern with horror comic books ending in the 1950s with the termination of Eerie and EC Comics.
In 1985, Parents Music Resource Center was founded, which is an American, like, censorship of music, ran mostly by Tipper Gore.
Yeah, Tipper Gore is old. Think of the children crew. I want to try a very brief thought experiment. Consider what you know now. All the knowledge by way of experiences, your education, your understanding of the world, everything you've absorbed. How much of that do you think you had when you were 8? Ballpark it. Maybe 10%. Thinking on the old adage that people fear what they don't understand, going by that, kids should be terrified all the time, but they're not. I think fearing what you don't understand only applies to adults. When you think you know how the world works, when you think you have everything figured out and something comes along and challenges that, it's unsettling. If our DNA is 98.8% chimp, then somewhere in that 1.2% is the instinct to explore for more than just food. Going beyond our comfort zone towards the unfamiliar and sometimes scary. That, by its nature, is what childhood is about, isn't it? Exploring the world, whether it's in person, in literature, TV, or movies. I think frightening stories can be useful to kids in that way, lending a bit of perspective and maybe challenging the coping mechanisms that come with moving beyond fear. I really had a blast going through these movies. Some brought back memories of me nervously watching and re-watching movies that scared and thrilled me. And I'm happy to say they hold up.
They really do. The only one that I had never seen was Return to Oz. But the other two are just ones that I always remembered scared the shit out of me. But I also loved them at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know me. I'm a little kid who was obsessed with Fright Night. And to me, that was one of my most favorite, you know, films that I had ever seen. So these ones that were more intended for kids, it's amazing that I still like them too. I would take anything that was scary, I think. If it was scary and you handed it to me as a child, I'd be like, that's great.
Yeah, I think Goosebumps often gets sort of name-checked as like, these were pivotal stories in my childhood. But then like people revisit them and they're like, that was pretty silly. Like that I don't know how well that works to a mature reader.
I don't know, because you know that Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark? You know that book? I loved that. It was like a Bible for me. And there was always this story, and I still think about it, and I still get scared about it occasionally. It was about this hair that was woven into a rug, and then the rug like creeps along the hallway to come get the guy. And like for some reason to me, if I hear just like a rustling kind of sound and it's really, really dark, I'm always thinking
check
of that.
The rugs.
I'm like, oh my God,
are they where we left
that
them?
Rug?
Burn
I don't know
it, burn
why.
It.
But that's one that, you know, sticks with you. And it's so funny as a kid, like certain things that just stick with you and other things that just kind of like, I don't care.
Yeah. Well, you know? I think psychologists have linked the like scary and traumatic moments of our history stay with us on account of those being like lessons learned because often they're moments that we've had to overcome something or, you know, we've had to live through and that in itself was challenging. In the past, when we've talked about kids' movies
right.
that we would have watched when we were kids, I haven't seen a lot of them. I feel like it's kind of a gap in my youth. All like for
I feel
that
like
matter,
you missed out.
Also, like Christmas movies and
then
like
what were you scared of as a kid?
People. I was like I was
human beings.
I was painfully shy. I still have a certain amount of social anxiety. I used to hide under furniture, like when my parents would have company,
like a cat. Oh, don't mind him. He's just curled up under the chair.
Don't take it personally. He doesn't want you to touch him or shake his hand. But like people, and that said, the movies are kind of a blind spot. I kind of attribute a lot of it to being the youngest of four, and there's like a 2-year gap between all my siblings, so they didn't want to watch kids' movies. Like right. We had cable. There were better things to watch, like more risque. So I missed out on a lot. I think of these movies, the only one I had seen before was The Witches.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah,
that's
well,
crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, because like, I watched The Witches probably in the theater, I bet. And then, like...
That was another thing. We never went. We never went to the movies.
We were a huge movie family. And yep. Not that we always would go to the movies. A lot of times we just had bootlegs because we were really, really poor. And we had, like, just shelves and shelves of VHS that was, like, all labeled.
Yeah, the 6-hour tapes that, mm-hmm. like, yeah, you'd long play.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I love that. but some, like, on special occasions, we would go to the movies and see things. So, like, I think I saw The Witches in the movie theater as a... I was little kid.
Now, you've mentioned that you cried a lot as a little kid.
I did.
Was it on account of fear?
No, I cried a lot. This isn't a funny story. No, I
might beg to differ. we'll see where this goes.
I cried a lot because I had overwhelming guilt over everything I did in my life, and I still do, but it's not like crippling to the same extent.
Was it?
Yeah, it was
guilt. What?
No, guilt about things.
From
like, if a friend got in trouble, I would feel guilty that somehow I got them in trouble, and then I would start crying.
Oh,
or
it's got a little bit of notes of OCD.
If someone just like sort of said something to me that was like, well, you know, you shouldn't do that. That's not nice or something. I would full out cry because then I'd be like, oh my gosh, I'm so guilty for making that person feel bad or something.
Wow.
Like it was guilt. It's not funny. So sad. That's what the crying was about. It was about guilt. Also, I was afraid
of
dying
too. That's pretty intense
for a little kid. I was like, not what? That I was afraid of dying. I was really sad that I would only live to be like 80 or something. And I felt like that was too short. And that also bothered me.
That's pretty intense for a little kid.
I was really,
although
really like upset with my own mortality.
Knowing that you saw Something Wicked This Way Comes, it makes a little more sense. Because that movie's obsessed with mortality. And, okay.
So there you go. There you go. Aren't you happy you asked? I'm like the best functioning kind of crazy person that there ever. Like, I'm so honest.
Don't we all kind of feel that way?
Yeah,
I feel like
I'm so honest with it, though.
With regularity, I think about just like day-to-day things where I'm just like, is no one going to acknowledge like how incredible it is that I just did that? Like an adult, like no one recognizes it. I'm a boy in a zipped up adult suit. Like this is all false.
Well, I like to do it with like my mental problems. So like a few years ago, you know, my dog passed away and I literally had no coping skills for that.
Oh.
And so then I had to like type in like coping skills for this, like an adult human
wow.
would. Like I'm like an alien. And I was like, how do people cope with this?
But that's so proactive and like mature. Yeah.
After I was already like devastated. Then I was like, I gotta figure out how to deal with this. How do other people do this?
Oh.
So I think I'm really, really well adjusted. For a weird little kid, I've become a decently adjusted human.
All right, let's get to a movie.
So we're gonna kick it off with 1990s The Witches. I'm
yeah.
so excited. Directed by Nicholas Roeg, who hasn't really done anything else that we really know, except for Don't Look Now.
Yeah, you like that movie?
Yeah, but I mean,
Donald Sutherland,
Julie
Christie.
That's kind of it.
He did David Bowie's The Man Who Fell to Earth. That's pretty cool.
Oh, that is pretty cool. I don't know why. I don't know. I don't have that on my radar here.
I've got a note that I do eventually. It's on my to-do list, but don't look now. I want to pair with the Changeling and do an episode.
Oh, yeah.
In that vein.
That would be good. I would watch that.
Or listen to it, as it would be.
Whatever we do here. It's actually written from a screenplay by Alan Scott, but the book is our favorite creepster, loves to creep out kids, Roald Dahl.
Yeah, Roald Dahl lived so many lives in The Greatest Generation. There's a really good, like, sort of Cliff's Notes comedy version of it on Comedy Central's Drunk History, where Will Ferrell plays Roald Dahl. He was during World War II, he was an English pilot. He was shot down. He was like really badly hurt, but mm-hmm. he pulled himself to safety. After that, he wanted to continue helping, so he was approached to be a spy for England. Like his compatriots, he ran in the same circles as Ian Fleming. Like yeah. these dudes were legit, and he was like a celebrated war hero. So you know he was the talk of the town. His reputation preceded him. And it made him the perfect person to, like, eavesdrop in on parties and just, like, start gathering information.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool life. And so all that shit happened before he ever started writing. Like, when he started writing his own accounts is when he sort of recognized and other people recognized that, like, this dude's got a talent for, mm-hmm. for writing stories. And then he starts writing kids' books.
Yeah, kids' books that are dark as hell.
All that said, he hated this movie. He didn't like it at all. He wanted his name off of it. And it was only Jim Henson who talked him into staying on board. But yeah, he was really displeased
by
it all.
To me, watching it, it seems like a very Roald Dahl kind of film. Like yeah. from just the way that certain things go, it's like you would see the artwork in the book.
And as dark as the movie is, I mean, it's sort of... Whatever, it was the 80s, it was a kid's movie, so it's going to sort of end happily ever after. But the movie goes to some pretty ugly, grim places.
Yeah.
And it's weird to think that the book goes even further.
Right,
like,
right.
there are permanent consequences in the book.
Roald Dahl was really obsessed with old people having to care for young children.
Yeah.
In, like, yeah. a really sad, creepy way. Like, the bedridden parents of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah. Or,
but they were the grandparents, you know, like... Oh, it's so scary.
Yeah. I mentioned Jim Henson. So he produced it, and his Jim Henson Studios did the special effects and puppetry to it. Holy hell. Wow. Like, it's really... Even the mice puppets...
Are great.
Are really good.
They're like, kind of adorable.
Yeah.
At the end, it's really, really cute. The final... One of the final transformations of Angelica Houston.
Ooh.
Oh, my God. It looks so... good, and for 1990 it still looks so freaking good.
Yeah, this was one that, like you said, we must have taped off of HBO because mm-hmm. we had a VHS of it, and so I haven't watched it since I was a kid, and there were just like whole scenes where I was like, this is a memory, like I remember all of these moments. And that said, I was too scared to watch the Angelica Houston moments. Like, that was... that like, I was, you know, kind of, like, watching through my fingers.
Those were my favorite parts. I loved Angelica Houston.
She's incredible in this.
Yeah.
And her German accent's not bad either.
Oh, I just loved her as a kid. I think I liked her so much because she had, like... She was fair, and she had, like, black hair, like me. That's
yeah.
why I also loved Winona Ryder.
Elvira-esque.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I loved that. I love her in this because she's so... She's so evil. She's so bad.
Yeah, and we'll talk about... There are some choices she makes in this that I want to talk about. But also starring Mae Zetterling as Grandma Evesham and Jason Fisher as the grandson Luke.
Mm-hmm.
He only made three movies. This, Hook, and the Steve Martin movie Parenthood.
Huh.
And I also noticed in Something Wicked This Way Comes, those kids also made a couple movies as children and then bailed.
Never again.
Like,
yeah.
They're probably well-adjusted adults.
They weren't very good, really, though. They're not very good actors. They're, like, selling insurance now or something, like, or real estate. They're very successful, probably, in real estate.
Also starring Mr. Bean.
Yes.
England's own Rowan Atkinson.
I didn't even remember that he was in it until
Me
I was
neither.
Watching it, and then I wrote it down. I just got excited. I think I didn't even make a note, just wrote Mr. Bean. So the synopsis is, a young boy, recently orphaned, is taken to England by his grandmother, At a hotel in which they're staying, a group of witches have gathered to prepare a plot to rid England of all children.
So just about at the 30-minute mark, we get the, like, conference room full of witches.
Yes.
It is the gathering where Angelica Houston is sort of about to present.
You may remove your shoes. You may remove your wigs. The doors. Are they locked and bolted?
Locked and bolted. Good.
At that 30-minute mark, she begins to peel off her face.
Yes, she does.
In an incredible special effect.
It's amazing. She looks amazing underneath.
Wow.
So creepy. But before that, we're being told a ghost or a bedtime kind of story by Grandma to the son before even the parents have died in whatever they died in. We don't know. It's kind of like vague. Car wreck, something.
Yeah, I guess dead. In the book, Luke was in the car wreck, but they kind of wanted to space
him
that
out of that.
a little too intense.
And Grandma is telling him about these witches, and she goes through a list of, like, this is what to look out for.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because they dress and look ordinary. There's a Grand High Witch who's the leader, and their main plot is nothing other than to kill children.
My orders are that every child in England shall be rubbed out, destroyed. Every single child eliminated. Do I make myself clear?
How much more sinister does it need to be?
Well, I don't know. Like, maybe they want money?
But
they work regular jobs. They have to be regular people, too.
Right, but I think the point is to, like, scare the hell out of kids. So, like,
right.
There's nothing more scary say that, like, you are their sole target.
Right.
Watch
right.
your back. And in those moments, I love that Roald Dahl almost completely rewrites the mythology mm-hmm. of witches. And I'm in. Like, boxed feet with no toes.
Exactly. Purple eyes.
Purple eyes.
And I liked how, because they have no toes and they have these, like, square feet, they can't wear pointed toe shoes.
Yeah, I like that.
That was a weird, weird touch. They're bald. And so they have to wear wigs. And for some reason, the wigs itch their heads.
Yeah.
And so they've got, like, all these, like, gnarly, like, scabs all over their heads when you finally see them.
In those crowd shots in the conference room, there are a number of male actors acting as women witches. And it's just, it adds to the, like, the off-putting, something's up.
And I like how they can smell kids, and the kids smell like dog shit. That's, like, the main thing is it
they
smells
can smell
bad.
Clean kids.
Right. But
right?
So Grandma says, like, maybe you shouldn't take too many showers because then they can't smell you. Like, what grandma says don't take a shower to a kid? Kids smell bad.
Yeah. Left to their own devices. Yeah.
Get your ass in the shower.
So I mentioned Angelica Houston making some curious choices. In the conference room, in her, like, keynote address, when they usher in Bruno, the chubby kid. And by the time he's at the front, Angelica Houston is in such, like, a tizzy. She is so worked up. She's gyrating. Like, it is oddly
it's
sexual.
Really, really sexual. I noticed that this morning and I was like, interesting choice. Maybe wouldn't have gone with that, but hey.
Yeah, but that much more off-putting.
Because,
like, adults
really
don't behave
up.
That way around children. So he should have known something was up, but he's just following his stomach.
That lady promised me 6 whole bars of cream whipped hazelnut milk chocolate. I've come to collect.
Ladies, may I introduce Bruno? Come up, Bruno. I have the chocolate here. I said 6:15. And that is in 15 seconds from now. You are in for a treat.
We all are.
What's going on?
Just
out of all the terrible, horrific things in this movie and scary parts, the part that actually like turned my stomach was when he was eating over all those scones and like the crumbs were falling on the other scones. Okay. And it really bothered me. Like it really, really turned my stomach because like food falling from his mouth into the plate where everyone is supposed to be eating from also. And it was really gross. And he deserved everything he got.
I hope there's butter in the sandwiches today. I really do hate margarine.
Yeah, there's a pretty straightforward lesson in the movie as far as like not taking candy or anything from strangers.
Mm-hmm.
But also Roald Dahl really, he's got something against like chubby kids who like candy.
Yes.
Between Bruno
Indulgent
here
children, yeah.
And Augustus Gloop and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm-hmm. Like he's got some contempt for the fatties.
He also has some contempt for wealthy people. Veruca Salt and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And this kid now is kind of combined those characters together because not only is he like a chubby guy who overindulges in food, he also is wealthy.
How much pocket money do you get? My dad's rich, but he's very tight. We've got 3 cars.
There's a scene eventually where the grandma has to tell Bruno's parents, hey, Bruno turned into a mouse.
I've got some bad news.
I've got some bad news. His mouse is talking and it is your son. And that father of Bruno is such a dick. He hits her.
Does he hit her?
Like he's like hitting her with like a napkin or whatever was in his hand because they don't want to move from their spot at the bar. All they wanted to do, they go to the bar at the same time every night and they just want to sit there and drink. And then grandma comes in and be like, your kid, this happened. And he starts like waylaying her with like
That's
a
right.
napkin or something.
Is Bruno? Come on, tell them, Bruno.
Get out of here. Just how dare you?
Come on, tell them,
Get
Bruno.
Get out of here.
It's Bruno.
It's me,
Ouch. Ouch. Out before I call the police. Now, bear me, old Rooney. Just
I don't
go
think
on.
They recognize me.
Little... Push off. Never come back, you stupid old witch.
I did my best, Bruno.
I guess Bruno was never resolved on camera. So he just goes with his folks and he's kind of satisfied to like be a small thing, and so all the sweets and all the food are giant to him. The portions are enormous now.
Which though, if a mouse really ate a candy bar, we had that happen in our house and it killed him because of all the caffeine and I guess sugar or whatever, and the mouse ran around and just died.
Should people be putting chocolate bars on mouse traps? Like at least,
well,
'cause like
if we ever had mice in the country, that's what my parents did. You give them a Rolo, because even if they pull the Rolo off of it, well, because it's sticky, you see. It's good. Everyone can learn from this. So you put the Rolo on, because even if it pulls the Rolo off of the trap, if it eats the Rolo, it's going to die.
Wow.
Good to know.
Good to know.
So when I see this like kid eating this chocolate bar as a mouse, I'm like, that's not going to end well.
Bruno ate himself to death later.
If he would have only held out. Oh.
A lot of the changes in the story infuriated Roald Dahl, who never again in his lifetime allowed any movie adaptations of his work and left in his will very specific and high standards for any future movies that would be made. And I think, didn't Netflix do James and the Giant Peach? I think they did an animated
version. Someone did
a
James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah, not that long ago. Yeah, so I don't know. I suppose that means like, there's a standard, the estate is looking after a standard of like verisimilitude between the stories and the movies. Yeah. But yeah, I love that as far as kids' movies go, Luke is a clever little strategist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that's how they get by. That's how they get over
right.
on the witches. And like those are always my favorite stories when the kids really have to like show cunning to win the day.
Right, right.
Yeah.
No, he is very smart. I think it's not some of the best child acting I've ever seen, but it's okay. And I do love how it is his plan and how he's teamed up with Grandma. I thought a tiny note of terrible sadness that Grandma has diabetes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was
at a
like,
time where you didn't hear a lot about diabetes.
Yeah.
You certainly didn't see a lot of it in movies.
Right, and I was just like, this is so sad. His parents died, now grandma is sick. What's going to happen?
Yeah, and another poke, like another Roald Dahl poke to like lay off the sweets, kids. Like it doesn't end well.
Don't smoke.
Like maybe, you know what, that might even be, I didn't put it together until now, but like the witch is not having toes is a little bit of like complications of diabetes.
That's
like they've had their fair share.
Yeah.
Yeah, just an idea.
Oh, I think that is kind of interesting.
And from one peculiar idea to a very peculiar movie, Return to Oz.
Oz.
In 1985, directed by Walter Murch, for the longest time, this was his only movie he ever directed until he did one episode of the Star Wars Clone Saga series. I feel like he, between the difficulty of making the movie and probably being cast in director jail and not really being given access again to a future film, is probably the reason for that long gap. But that said, like, I think he directed the shit out of this movie.
I don't agree with you. Yeah. You know what's so funny? This guy is known for being in the sound department, sound editor. Everything from boom mic operator. This guy had worked his way up in the system of sound editing in the sound department. And one of the worst things about this movie is the bad sound editing.
Oh, really? I did not.
Everything is so echoey. It's on these really echoey stages, sound stages.
Yeah.
Everything has an echo, and I'm thinking, you're the sound guy. Like, what are you doing?
Written by Walter Murch and Gil Dennis, based on the second and third novels by L. Frank Baum. I think when people think Wizard of Oz, of course, they go to the 1939 film. And that movie took a lot of liberties to soften edges and make it sort of crowd-pleasing. You also have to consider the sensibilities of 1939.
Right.
That said, it still has its scary moments. Like, as a little kid, I was fucking terrified of flying monkeys.
You know, but when I was a little kid, I hadn't watched it until after The Wiz. That's always my Wizard of Oz story.
That's right.
And so I thought it was just a ripoff of The Wiz. And I was like, this is like a lame version of The Wiz.
Yeah.
The
Where's the soul, people? Where's the rhythm? Starring Piper Laurie, Carrie's mom.
Yeah, who we will talk about later when we do Jason Robards, but also in my favorite film, Dream a Little Dream.
Is she?
She's married to Jason Robards in that film.
Okay.
Oh, so good.
And a 10-year-old Firouza Balk, who I think everybody knows from The Craft.
Of course.
She was in American History X, and she pops up in things from time to time. I love her. I think she's fantastic, and she plays one of the all-time great villains in The Craft.
Oh, absolutely. She's one, though, that I always confuse with Debbie Mazar. They're like the same person to me.
I'm not sure who. Wait, who's Debbie?
You probably just think it's Firouza Balk in things when you see her.
She's getting all the credit, or Firouza Balk is. Yeah, so now Judy Garland was like 15, 16 years old when she made The Wizard of Oz. And so Dorothy goes from that version of 15, 16 to Firouza Balk was only 10 years old when she made this.
Yeah, little girl.
It's as if she rode the the merry-go-round from Something Wicked backwards and wound up as a younger version of Dorothy. But that said, when she arrives in Oz, like, she is the thing of legend. Everybody knows Dorothy.
Right.
And I kind of dig that, like, the world continued when she left.
Your Majesty, she has returned to Oz.
Good, good. Keep an eye on her.
And she finds it in shambles.
It was cool. I've never read any of the stories, so it was cool. This is the first time I ever saw this movie. I was watching it for the show, and I thought it was really cool to think, like, yeah, what does happen to her after she comes back and she has to live in the real world, even though she knows this magic stuff happens?
Yeah.
And what's going on in Oz while she's gone?
It turns out everybody had a rough go of it after that point. This was not a happily ever after story. The film stands as the sequel with the most time passed between the first and second. And that said, Murch didn't want it to be thought of as a sequel, knowing that that's what it would be compared against would really throw people off. He was going to the source material, and the source material is substantially darker. The movie is based on the second and third Oz books, The Marvelous Land of Oz and Ozma of Oz. And elements from the former include the introduction of Jack Pumpkinhead, the witch Mombi, and the Powder of Life, and other elements like the flying sofa, Princess Ozma, the chicken Bellina, which kind of stands in for Toto.
Yeah. So, firstly, there was a lot of the general mood of this movie kind of depressed me for some reason. Like, I was really bothered by this whole film. And it starts off with she leaves Toto, and Toto's like following after them on their horse-drawn carriage thing, And he follows them down the road. And then she's like, is he going to be okay? And Piper Laurie's kind of a bitch. And she's like, yeah, he'll be fine. And it's like, but that's your dog. And you just left.
Well, let's talk about where she was going. So all the excitement of visiting the land of Oz and then coming back and having to live on a farm in the middle of nowhere.
And your house is gone, by the way. Yeah. So the house doesn't get magically repaired after the first one.
So like when kids get excitable, they have a hard time sleeping. Dorothy has a real hard time sleeping, and her parents, like, it doesn't seem to take much to arrive them at their wit's end, where they're just like, we need a hard fix for this problem, because this kid won't go to sleep, and she's useless to us on the farm when she's drowsy all the time.
I know you don't want to go to the doctor's, but you just haven't slept the night right through since the tornado. And then you're no help to me in the morning.
And him. My friends are in trouble. I know it.
We are in trouble, Dorothy. Lost the old house in the tornado. Never before had to have a mortgage. Now we may have to have two.
Right. And something's going on with her uncle, sort of. Like, and M, like, Auntie M is kind of giving the husband a side eye and basically calling him lazy. He's injured and he cannot do work. And Piper Laurie is just like giving him like shit.
That's
basically
very country. Rub some dirt on it, walk it off.
Yeah. And you're just like, this man's injured. He cannot climb on a ladder and make a new house. But houses are hard to make, I think.
But they do have this cutout from the circular where like the age of electricity has finally come to Kansas. And that's going to be the solution to their problems, because shock therapy offers a solution that otherwise wasn't available.
And that is terrifying.
Isn't it?
So
it could be worse. They could have lobotomized her.
It's true.
It was that era.
It could have been worse. But I'm thinking to myself, like, I got about like maybe halfway through the film and I stopped and I was going, maybe she is having shock therapy and this is all some grand delusion as she's like frying her brain.
Psychotic
right
split.
Yeah.
As a result.
And I was like, shit. And then I realized that wasn't the case, but I thought it for a second.
Yeah. I think the books play more with the idea that Oz is a physical realm. Mm-hmm. In the 39 movie, it's more of like, you know, representational.
But it wasn't a dream. It was a place. And you were there.
So thinking back to the first one where it's like, yeah, you were there and all this stuff, these characters are very different than that 39 movie.
Yeah.
And the Tin Man story is gruesome and I loved it.
Yeah.
The Tin Woodsman used to be made of flesh, like everybody else. But then he cut off his leg. He had a tin leg made. But then a witch enchanted his axe. And he kept on cutting off all the other parts of his body. Until he was all made of tin. Even his head was...
That's all right, Dorothy.
Yeah, hacks off his limbs one by one, replacing them with tin. And so you know then, since he's an entirely tin man, that he's cut off every limb in his body.
And it's almost an aside where, like, the adults around her need to hear this story to prove how nutty she's become.
Right.
And when she's essentially quoting the books.
Exactly.
And they're just like, oh my God, run current through her brain right now.
Well, shit, that's a crazy story. If a kid told me that, I'd be like, where did you come up with this?
I think that kid has a fucking great imagination.
God, it's dark.
So the estimated budget was around $25 million, and that's counting a number of budget cuts. Disney actually fired the director, Walter Murch, about a week into production because they weren't satisfied with the speed, and they thought production was falling behind. And so he lobbied old friends, Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas, both of which he had done a lot of sound work for, and also Steven Spielberg, good people to have in your corner.
Yeah.
They wrote and campaigned for him, and so he was rehired. I don't know if that's ever happened in film history before or since, but pretty cool that, like,
how do you think they felt after they watched it though?
I think I still stand by this being a solid flick.
Oh, okay.
It's weird, I'll grant you, it's weird and creepy and dark, but it's a good movie.
All right.
That said, there was change ups in the management of Disney. They still cut the budget and they still sort of screwed them with the release. They did not publicized the movie very well, and they limited it to a very short theatrical run. One of my favorite characters that vivid memories from my childhood was her sort of bodyguard, TikTok.
Well, TikTok, if
first thing we have to do is to escape from the Wheelers. They're outside and said they're going to throw us into the deadly desert.
From now on, I will be your obedient servant. If you keep me wound up, make sure my think works are extra tight and I will formulate a plan.
Yeah.
Even now, looking at that character, like, I can't really figure out how they made that work, because it is a, like, bow-legged, giant sort of kettle-shaped robot that, like, moves with a surprising amount of dexterity. I don't know if there was a person inside that.
I assume there was a person in there.
But the legs are so widely spread apart. I wonder. I don't have an answer for that. But that said, like, the puppeteering in the movie, and even the special effects, age incredibly well.
Yeah, the puppeteering is really great. I love the chicken the whole time. I'm loving that chicken. I think for the era, for 1985, the Pumpkinhead man, he looks great.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he looks great. And then when we finally are introduced to the Scarecrow later on, I think that still looks pretty great.
Yeah, yeah. I think there was a note that they had greater ambitions for the Scarecrow character as far as, like, giving him an animatronic face, but instead they just sort of did, like, you've got a scared face, you've got a happy face, you've got a sad face.
I liked it, though.
Yeah,
because
it worked.
It's a book. It's a children's book. I don't care for multi-dimensional kind of, it doesn't occur to me or bother me about that. I did notice, though, so some interesting voice work going on. Did you recognize, I think maybe you haven't seen this movie, did you recognize the chicken Belina, her voice?
I thought she was Sister Lazarus from Sister Act. I'm wrong. I looked it up. I did not recognize her name when I looked it up.
No, she's the trash lady in the Labyrinth.
Oh.
And it's the exact same character, kind of. It's like a sort of southerny accent, crackly sound.
Yeah.
And it, like, plays like a mother hen to the other character.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, I know this voice. I know this voice. And then the Pumpkinhead man, he talks in this really weird, creepy way. And I don't know if this was because of a direction of it, but what I kept hearing, because I was watching it, you know, in a very small screen and listening to it on my headphones, if you know what I mean, where I was watching this film. And it was like, I kept hearing it and it sounded like Mrs. Herdicure from Brain Candy, that Scott Thompson character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because at one point in time...
Oh, a little bit dizzy.
Exactly. And at one point in time, the Pumpkinhead man says, I feel awfully dizzy. And I was like, no shit. No shit. I was like, it's Scott Thompson. Oh, my God.
I couldn't stop thinking of Jack Skellington, thinking that, like, that character was essentially adapted from the Pumpkinhead.
Yeah, but, like, here. Made way better.
Sure. And better voice. I'll grant you that. But, yeah. I mean, I think this movie, whether subconsciously or consciously, I think this movie had a cultural impact in, like, the few people who did see it at the time.
I mean, there are... So instead of the monkeys in this one, we have the Wheelers.
Yeah.
And they're... kind of, firstly, they're just crazy. They seem to just be insane people riding around on wheels on their hands and feet.
Come here, chicken!
Ah, a wheel!
If you remember when PS2 first came out, there was a racing game called, like, Kinetic or Kinetica or something like that. And people raced with wheels on their hands.
Oh.
And PS2 time, this was like, wow, hot shit. It was like an amazing game. And that's what it reminded me of. So it was like they must have seen this.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. 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 They're frightening. And then the guy tips his head up to reveal that, like, what we were initially the terrifying face was actually a mask.
Right.
And underneath it is an even more frightening human being.
Exactly. Just as insane and could care about anything. Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's elements of this movie. It felt Terry Gilliam-esque as far as the sensibility. And it's weird to think that, like, you know, this started off as a Disney project. They inherited the right – didn't inherit. They paid for the rights after MGM gave it up, and the stories themselves were in public domain. So I think the only thing they wound up actually paying for in terms of rights to MGM was the ruby slippers.
Mm-hmm.
going back to Jack Skellington, not Jack Skellington, Jack Pumpkinhead. Wow, his name is actually Jack. That's
yeah,
funny.
It is.
A fellow with boundary issues. A little creepy yes. when he asks a 10-year-old if he can call her mother.
I wrote that down too. I said I felt really uncomfortable that he called her mom. It made me really uncomfortable.
Yeah, and Dorothy's
and he kept
like,
doing it.
All right. Like she, yeah, it's a weird idea. And he knows she's not his mom, but that is the comfort
it
she
really
finds.
Made me uncomfortable. Yeah. And then I was like, maybe I'm the only one. So I'm glad that you said something because I was like, why does this bother me so badly?
Yeah. It's funny to think this movie is labeled as fantasy, adventure, and family. It's also a family movie. Mm. But I'm including it as horror because there are moments that are truly frightening to me as an adult. And
let's
maybe
talk about that Wicked Witch.
Yeah. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
She has multiple heads that she has farmed, essentially, from people, keeps them locked up in cages, and takes them when she wants to put them on.
Yeah, they're all her, but they're all different.
Yeah.
And so she kind of like decides what, I mean, it's essentially clothing to her, like what mood she's in.
But
and
they were real people's heads at one point in time, because you see the bodies that she took them from at one point.
Yeah, that scene really gave me the chills. And when Dorothy sort of figures out that like her escape is going to have to involve the life-giving powder, mm-hmm. and that gets kept in like the nightstand next to the headless witch, that like Mission Impossible moment where she's sneaking up and trying to like pull the key from her, you know, that's strung around her wrist, and then open up the case, and there is her like primary head,
right?
And next to that is the powder. And the moment that head wakes up and starts screaming at her, and then all the other heads start screaming,
and then this
at
body
her.
Comes walking with no head.
Oh my god,
Dorothy girl.
That was great. There's other elements like the desert. If you touch the sand in the desert, which good thing Dorothy remembered because shit, I would have been like tromping right through the sand and died immediately. But if you touch the sand, you turn into sand and die. And we see a few Wheelers bite the dust.
I do. So that moment when Dorothy does touch down in Oz, it is in the middle of the desert. And that's also like the first real conversation she has with, I keep forgetting, is it
Belina,
the chicken. I love the imagination that's already sort of been established that Dorothy has seen some shit,
mm-hmm.
and that she's not weirded out by a talking chicken.
Right.
When did you learn to talk anyway? I thought hens could only cluck and cackle.
Ah, strange, ain't it? How's my grammar?
If we were in the Land of Oz, your talking wouldn't be strange at all.
Ah, there goes the water.
Dorothy calls attention to the idea that talking chicken ain't so weird if we were in Oz. And I kind of love that idea that, like, her imagination's been tested. She has seen some things.
Right.
And so, you know, a talking chicken is just something she rolls with.
Yeah, she's like, if we were in Oz, this would happen. And she's like, but this wouldn't happen in Kansas. And she's like piecing it together pretty well. She's very well adjusted for someone who clearly the family has given her no coping mechanisms because they're just going to shock her into thinking correctly. So they clearly don't have any idea of like how to help her and talk to her. But she's really well adjusted.
She's adaptable.
Yeah.
Word gets passed around by the rocks in the desert and finally up to the Gnome King that there's a chicken in Oz.
And the whole time I'm like, what the hell is... What, it's a chicken. It's okay, guys.
What's the matter? What is it?
She has a chicken with her.
Chicken!
Not only, like, are afraid, they hate chickens. Everyone hates chickens.
Right, and that point is kind of brought up and then let alone...
And then they bring it up again and I'm going... Calm down with the chicken talk.
But I felt it was better placed than in the original Oz when Dorothy throws water on the witch. Like, mm-hmm. did we know that she was going to fucking melt to a pile
That's
of goo?
True.
That was just kind of like a deus ex machina at the last moment. Whereas here we've kind of established that like something's up with chickens.
Right, right.
They got something against chickens.
I thought like maybe it was just rare and they wanted to eat the chicken for a while. And then I did kind of think like, well, that was kind of lucky. At the end, I was like, that was kind of lucky.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fantasy novel. So if it wasn't this, it was going to be, you know, it was going to be magic. It was going to be witchcraft of some sort.
Right, it's very War of the Worlds, you know.
Well, it's funny. I was going to phrase it as the only Oscar that this was nominated for, as if it deserved all the Oscars. But I won't go that far.
No,
I won't go that far.
Let's not go crazy.
But I will gripe that this was nominated for Best Visual Effects, but lost to Cocoon. What kind of bullshit is that?
Because Cocoon had like the glowing kind of people. Like that was cool shit in 1985, I think.
Yeah, but compare it to all the work done in this, all the practical effects on set, and even like the rock people. Like there's so much depth.
Yeah, but 1985, you're really living in a Jim Henson world. And Jim Henson he was just amazing. And it was things people had never seen before. And I think this was just, you know, kind of similar.
I think it speaks to the Oscar committee and how it generally slants old. Like they literally like go and try and publicize it like old folks homes in LA because
right.
like there are retired actors who are still part. And like I think old people see Cocoon and they're like, that's great. I wish I
Maybe.
Could go and live forever in space. Like, but it doesn't make up for the difference that like the special effects in this are unparalleled compared to Cocoon.
I don't know. I mean, I can't speak because I haven't seen Cocoon in years and years and years. So maybe it's amazing. You don't know.
Could
when was the last
back.
Time you saw it?
I was probably 12. I don't know. It was a long, long time ago. It was my, I don't know. In the days of Police Academy, I'd watch anything with Steve Guttenberg.
I understand that feeling. I do. No, I really think it's a Jim Henson kind of thing, though, because people, you know, Jim Henson was so revolutionary, right? And so you expected a certain level and this isn't better than Jim Henson.
Yeah, but I think it hits that mark. This wasn't in competition against Jim Henson. I think
no,
this...
but it's just, I think people had expected that. Like, if you see animatronics or you see puppetry at that time, at that you know point in time in history, I think you expect it to be that caliber. Because you imagine Labyrinth is 1 year later,
mm-hmm.
and that's really some great fucking Jim Henson work.
Sure.
You know, so. And that blows this out of the water. Labyrinth really blows this out of the water as far as effects go. And that's only 1 year difference.
I don't know if I agree entirely, but all right. Yeah, no, it was a high bar, certainly. For those interested, in addition to the movie, there was a Kickstarter campaign for a documentary called Remembering Return to Oz. That
is that necessary?
It was, I mean, I think so. I think the more people see that, there's a reason it's a cult classic. There's a reason it's available.
I figured out. I just raised my hand. I just figured out how they made TikTok's legs so bowed.
Okay.
It was a man who was standing kind of upside down, and his legs were actually arms in the suit. He was backwards and upside down, and that's how he got that weird like gait that TikTok has.
Wow, and that wasn't a lot of space. Like, TikTok is big, but not so big that a cramped acrobat is like
upside down, walking on his hands.
That's intense. They should have won something for that. That sounds like a pretty high level of difficulty.
And if you fell over, you might just start rolling. You know, it's very dangerous.
So you weren't wild about this one,
no,
but this next
not.
One does hold a near and dear place in your heart.
One of my favorites.
1993's Something Wicked This Way Comes. Directed by Jack Clayton, who also directed the Robert Redford Great Gatsby, mm-hmm. and a movie we should cover from 1961, the gothic horror The Innocents.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Classic horror. This one was all Ray Bradbury. He wrote the, as it turns out, original screenplay that never got optioned. He wanted Gene Kelly to be in the film. That's how far back this goes. And when they couldn't get the project off the ground, he decided, like, I will do what I can. I will novelize this.
Uh-huh.
And so the novel came from the idea from the screenplay and then back again now in for 1983, the adapted screenplay. That said, Disney tampered a lot with it. So it wasn't his original vision, nor was it Jack Clayton's. And so they were pretty frustrated that, Disney kind of usurped them. Starring Jason Robards.
Yeah, I love Jason Robards.
Yeah, he was always...
Like, I love him.
In the movies of my childhood, he was always a grandpa character. Yeah. So this for this show is the first time I ever saw this movie. I don't know if I ever saw snippets of it the way I would other movies, but in this case, like, you know, all these recognizable faces.
It played on TV, I think, every October. You would see this on TV. Yeah. And so that's why... I love this movie. I'm obsessed with it. But also Jason Robards, because he's in one of my most favorite movies, Dream a Little Dream.
Oh, yeah.
He's amazing in that, too. Don't you worry. I don't know. This is one of those, I whenever it's on TV, I'll watch it. And I'll, even if I'm only watching a clip of it, it's like, yeah. I'll watch it.
Also starring Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah.
Diane Ladd. Pam Grier as the Dust Witch. Yeah. And every other... woman in the carnival. She's playing she's multiple everything. Roles.
Because at first I was like, is that Pam Grier? Oh, no, wait. This is Pam Grier. Wait, was that Pam Grier? That's what I kept finding myself doing.
All Pam Grier. Yeah. And Vidal Peterson as Will. Brief synopsis. In a small American town, a diabolical circus and its demonic proprietor prey on the townsfolk. I thought this was a little bit like a spiritual prequel to Needful Things.
I could see the feel is very similar.
Yeah, and I read it on the internet, so it must be true. But apparently Stephen King might have written a treatment for this movie.
I did read that.
And I don't know if that's true necessarily, but that certainly binds the two ideas together. Mm-hmm.
This film has music composed by James Horner, and the music is outstanding. It's a huge, beautiful, like, live orchestra score.
It's so strong. I felt that, like, there were definitely nods to classical pieces. Like,
absolutely.
Is it Night on Bald Mountain?
Yes, there was. There was some Mussorgsky. There was some other stuff that we expect to hear. Some Peter and the Wolf in there.
Okay.
So it was really well thought out, and it was in the way that Copland used to take, you know, old music and put it in to make new stuff. This is what James Horner was doing, and I think this movie, like, is really made by those moments.
Yeah, and it's so well written that it does feel like classical pieces. It feels like they've taken classical, like, dark pieces of classical music and inserted them into the movie.
Yeah.
And that said, like, all that happened after the fact. Apparently, like, this movie kind of went the same road as The Exorcist as far, like, the way they originally brought in Lalo Schifrin to do the score, and a piece of his score appears in the trailer, in the original trailer for The Exorcist. But then William Friedkin had a, you know, meltdown and threw it all out. And so in this case, the original score was composed by George Delarue, but Disney wasn't having it. They gave him the boot, and so the prolific James Horner stepped in to fill it out. And yeah, those editorial moments, again, like, Disney stepped in, and this movie went through like a year of post-production because they weren't really satisfied with the cut. It did not test well. This movie did not test
it's
well, nor perform
as hell.
Well. Yeah, yeah. We were talking about that.
The fear is the mortality.
Yeah.
That's the scary part of everything.
The conversations between Jason Robard and, as Will's dad, pontificating on his lifelong cowardice and his own, like, fear of death.
Yeah.
It's really strange to see that in a narrative for children. And so that's why, like, The Witches is more akin to, like, a monster movie at times. And so that is this sort of, you know, basic plot as far as fear and intimidation. This movie is, like got existential dread. This is frightening
for adults. It's a psychological drama.
Yeah.
Is what this is. And what's so funny is, I mean, this is all probably, I guess, things that shaped my life or whatever, but this film, it is, the monster in it is not exactly Jonathan Pryce and not exactly any of the carnival. It's like facing your own mortality and your decisions that you made that you can't change.
Right, but also going back to you being scared as a little kid on account of guilt, like, these characters are sort of presented with the alternate timeline that could have been,
right,
and the life that that they could have had. And like, what a torturous thing to do to people. Like, that is, I mean, I do not like the Wishmaster series.
Uh-huh.
But this movie does that so much better.
Yeah, I would love even to have this be remade. I mean, obviously, Jason Robards, no one would ever do as well as Jason Robards in this role. But I would love to have some kids who are really great actors in it, you know?
You really don't like any
They're
of these kids.
It's just not good. It's just not good. And this will just kind of give you like a little bit more insight. One of my favorite Dr. Seuss books was Your Only Old Ones. It's about the old people having to go into the old people home and like they have to go to the hospital all the time.
I don't know that one.
It's the most depressing Dr. Seuss book, and it is one of my favorites. And it should, I mean, watch Something Wicked This Way Comes and then read Dr. Seuss as a companion piece.
Well, I'll tell you something, son. When you see the end of things coming close and staring at you, it's not what you've done that you regret. It's what you didn't do. And most of all, that afternoon at the river, when there was nothing I could do, Will. Blame my father, if you like. Blame me. We gotta stop blaming sometime.
I love the town. I love the atmosphere. The story opens with narration, and they sort of drop in bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. It's actually a note of mine that, like, narration right up front is usually a tip-off that the studio intervened and said, like, you have to explain this shit to people.
Right. No one knows what's going on.
Yeah. And so part of those explanations are the townspeople, and so we've get these characters like Ed, the one-armed, one-legged bartender, who, as far as bartenders go, would probably have some pretty great stories. Like, all that dude's missing is an eye patch.
He's a war hero.
Oh, I missed that point, but I kind of assumed, it was a traumatic thing. And so later in the story, when there is one of my, it might be my favorite moment in the story, just because it was a brilliant arrival point for that character. When Ed returns as a child, mm-hmm. and has the football in hand because he was a football star in high school, and throws James Robard the football, mm-hmm. and then catches it back. He only catches it with his right arm because that's what he's used to, only using that right arm for probably the last 20 years. Yeah, that was really fucking eerie to watch a little kid take on this personality of a one-armed, one-legged dude.
Right, right. I love that character. I mean, it's really, really well thought out. This whole story is so well thought out because what I love, and I think what's so sad about him, is that he's like a happy-go-lucky guy, and everyone likes him, and he likes everybody in the town. And so you think, oh, he's cool with this. You know, he's fine being how he is. He's come to terms with it and everything. And still Mr. Dark can tempt him.
Yeah.
And so it's like, just because someone seems okay and looks okay and interacts with people, that's not 100% of the truth. And like, oh, that's freaking dark. So dark.
Yeah. And it's particularly a nice sinister touch that Mr. Dark is kind of tempting these people with things that they might not even consider they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's only faced with that option that, like, you mean I can have this?
Right.
Like, I'll do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we're also introduced to the lonely barber, but also a seemingly kind of rapey barber. I'm not exactly 100% sure that his love for women is like that he wants to share his life with somebody.
You can't smell it, can you?
Smell what?
Powder. Ladies powder and perfume. The sweet smell of rustling petticoats. Smells to me like we're going to have visitors. Elegant visitors. Beautiful ladies.
You'll have to make do with the ladies you got here, Mr. Grissetti. We don't get any visitors in this town. Not in October. Or any other time of the year, come to that.
Yeah, a little bit of a creep.
Yeah, he was a total creep because he was really seemingly only interested in the smell of women, which is creepy.
Give me their hair.
Gross. But there he is, you know, obviously tempted by Pam Grier because she's pretty smoking hot in this film.
Yeah. There's a great cameo role by Angelo Rosito from 1932's Freaks and also Master Blaster from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Yep. Yeah, he's in the festival, and that dude, when he turns it on to be creepy.
Sorry, boys, too young. Come back in 10 years.
There's a point in that where Mr. Dark says, we're going to turn the other kid into a baby. Mm-hmm. And give it to my friend. So we know even the people who are in Mr. Dark's group of people.
Yeah, the carnival folk.
They still have things that they want, you know? So it's like he's this little, like, evil man that's wandering around with Mr. Dark, but he still wants a kid. I mean, I hope probably not to eat. I think it seems like he wants it for
just Yeah, he kind of talked about it like it would be like a plaything for
yeah.
him. And, like, that's a weird way to think of a baby.
I know. And so there's so many, like, little tiny things that are going on throughout the entire story. We have the sad teacher. She's so depressingly sad.
Yeah, and doesn't really refer to her students by name, just as the Whisperers.
Mm-hmm.
My two little Whisperers.
Good band name, but, like, a weird way to refer to kids.
Right, exactly.
Who, like, yeah, they were the only two kids in detention. She should know their names.
Yeah, exactly.
Little self-obsessed. And it turns out a little obsessed with, like, her lost or misspent youth.
Right.
In addition to the creepy characters, we got the creepy ginger kid who before the backwards carousel was just the creepy gingerbread man. when he comes out of the teacher's house, like that, yeah, I don't know. The kids in this movie are so well directed. I think it's funny that you're not a fan of the acting, or at least the acting of the good
main
kids.
The two kids, yeah.
Yeah. But everybody else in this movie, the kid who's playing the bartender, Ed's younger self, and the ginger kid, like, they were really off-putting. They were doing all the right things to, like, really unsettle me. Maybe I have a thing about kids. I don't know. I don't.
They creep me out. But we should explain, if you haven't seen the film, when Mr. Dark's carnival comes into town, number one, he has a magic mirror house that gives kind of people what they would want to see. But also he has this carousel that if it goes backwards, I said it like carousel, like that Michael York film. Carousel. But it's a carousel. I don't know how to say it. It's a carousel that if you go backwards, it goes back in time and makes you younger.
Yeah.
But you seemingly know what's going on still, so.
Right. You do maintain who you were before. I mean, we're assuming, but it does feel that way as far as, like, in the sort of, like, creepy maturity of the children who come off of that, right?
Right.
Yeah. And on that note, also a little bit of, like, perhaps an inspiration to Big, because one of the kid, Nightshade, the other kid, talks about wanting to be older and taking that carousel forward and being older. And that's,
right.
you know, that's not a far stretch from Tom Hanks sort of asking at the carnival for the fortune teller to make him big.
Right. And the dynamic between the two of them is that they're friends, the two kids. But yeah, Nightshade wants to be bigger. And the blonde, the Jason Robards kid, all he wants is them to stay friends.
Yeah.
And so it's like he sees the writing on the wall that, hey, when we get older, we're not going to be friends.
Yeah, like Dr. Seuss says, you only get old once.
It's true.
The boys apparently took the merry-go-round before the tarantula scene. I don't know if you remember the stark difference in age. Like, they hit puberty.
I didn't notice, I guess.
It was one of the scenes that they filmed late after the production wrapped. And so it was an insert scene, and they've hit puberty. They are far more mature than they were in the preceding scene.
I just went along for the ride. I didn't even notice.
Even when the kid, like, yelps, it's kind of like a voice break. You're like, ugh.
just like that. That's how you sounded.
Still happens to me from time to time.
If Pam Grier came to your room to scare you, what would she put in there? Mosquitoes. You have a problem with them. But you're not afraid of them.
No, it would. No, like maybe an old person with visible facial hair that shouldn't be there. Like, who wants a kiss? Like, that's kind of that's the thing that kind of freaked me out a little bit as a little kid. Is that wrong to say? You're like cringing.
Yeah,
like,
it's pretty wrong.
It's. What do you want me to say? Like, I maintain
no
that
bugs
shit.
Or.
I mean, bugs
animals?
A little bit. Are there No, I mean, a bear. If Pam Grier brought a bear with her and left it in the room.
Fair enough.
I probably would have heard them coming up the stairs.
Yeah, probably. I don't think they're quiet. I don't know much about bears.
Well, I mean, terrifying because, whatever. No, it's a tangent about bears. Bears don't give a fuck if you're living or dead. Like, cats will kill you before dragging you off somewhere. Uh-huh. Bears start eating you alive.
Yeah. I mean, I get your fear of bears, very similar to your fear of sharks and everything. But, like, mm-hmm. No creepy crawlies. Nothing like that bothers you.
Not really. I guess I've never really been in the situation where I'm, like, covered or surrounded by a lot of bugs. Mm. I had some fire ant experiences in Puerto Rico, I guess. That was upsetting. But not like permanently scarring. Are there any memories from childhood that kind of linger with you as far as phobias?
Well, I'm afraid of worms.
Really? Just like garden worms?
Yeah, I don't want to step on them.
Okay.
And so I'm terrified of them.
I get antsy like after a heavy rain step on them. When they're on the sidewalks.
It kind of sometimes renders me like unable to move. If there's a bunch, like in where my parents live, like, yeah, I've had someone carry me from my car to my house because I will not cross the sidewalk.
I'm afraid of worms, Roxanne, worms.
I'm terrified. So, yeah, and I don't like cockroaches.
That's fair.
If I can see them, I'm okay. Like, but I don't like when they come at me.
I'm curious.
Because they're very aggressive here.
You grew up in the country. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Puerto Rico where... the cockroaches fly. That's a creepy concept.
We didn't really have them in the country.
No?
We don't really have them. We had...
it's just New York that sort of really emboldened.
Exactly. We had like cicadas that we like grab onto you, and obviously terrifying, but nothing like a cockroach. Oh, God, they're so oily.
I guess that's a memory. So that's a specific incident that like, I guess bugs really don't freak me out that much. A couple of years ago, Rachel and I were in Wisconsin. It was very late at night. We're like... unpacking a car. So there's like one light over the car. Otherwise, it's
like June
blackness.
Bugs.
Yeah.
They're so gross.
It was in Rachel's hair. And I knew
they don't let go.
If I were to say, Rachel, you have a June bug in your hair, you know, she's going to run. She's going to like make
it
impossible.
Who knows where she'll go? She'll go to Canada.
So I didn't say anything. I just said, Rachel, stay still. And I reached into her hair and I like uncoupled this fucking monster from her head. Mm-hmm. It was really fucked up. But in that moment, yeah, I guess I wasn't. I was that kind of kid who liked bugs. So they don't really skeeve me out that much.
Fair enough. One more character to point out is the only one who really couldn't be tempted by Mr. Dark, the seemingly town drunk / crazy guy.
The lightning rod salesman?
Yeah, what is that? And this is supposed to be taking place in a small town in Illinois. I don't know. I've never seen a lightning rod salesman, right? Is that a thing that people did?
I have no idea where people, so I mean.
Is this some Midwestern thing that I never was privy to? I don't know.
Oh, Tom Fury says the lightning shall jump the world and make men hop and skip like scalded cats.
You fool. Lightning shall make you hop and make you tell.
Tom, don't do. Tom Fury has a secret.
When?
And for that guy to be like the town kind of hobo.
Mm-hmm.
It was, yeah. I mean, when they presented early in the movie, whatever, any experienced movie viewer is going like, I wonder if this is going to come back into play towards the end. I just think
it's interesting that he's the guy with nothing, essentially, nothing. And yet he wouldn't change it for anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone else has all these things and still they would want to change. And he's kind of like, who even knows where he lives? He probably lives under a bridge for all we know.
By the pricking of my thumb, something wicked this way comes.
Then rang the bells both loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep.
The wrong will fail, the right prevail. With peace on earth, goodwill to men.
It's 1,000 years to Christmas, Mr. Howley.
Wrong. It's here, in this library, tonight, and can't be spoiled.
Did Will and Jim bring it with them on the soles of their shoes? Then we shall have to scrape them.
Between all these movies, Return to Oz has some pretty upsetting moments, I could imagine, for children. But as far as Something Wicked This Way comes, I could see the last 10 minutes being a little too scary for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about the, like, existential dread and the sort of impending mortality that's on display. Jason Robards' character sort of facing his, like, lifelong cowardice. And,
yeah.
like, you know, his is really the character arc of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoy that. But I think for children, it could be too much. The last 5 minutes are pretty fucked up.
That's some really good work, too. For 1983, there's a great transformation at the end. And I don't want to give it away, but there's a great transformation that makes a really creepy effect.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that was definitely part of the original when Disney sort of Disney-fied elements. They threw in a lot of, like, the composite scenes. So some of the stuff that doesn't age great mm-hmm. as far as, like, you know, the illumination of things or, you know, sort of a fog spreading over a field on its way to the house. Like, some of that stuff doesn't work especially well. And that was Disney kind of saying, again, like, we've got to Mickey Mouse this shit and really explain mm-hmm. it to people. So it's kind of frustrating that the movie was taken away from Clayton. But how dark would it have been? I think it would have been dark on the level of, like, Return to Oz. I think it would have been almost, like, unredeemably dark. And that said, like, even in this state, this movie did not perform well. This was like a late cult hit where, you know, you probably had a lot of, like, people who might have watched it early, then presenting it to their kids.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, like, in its era, this was a failure. This was not a Disney success.
I can't remember the first time I ever saw it. I was little. Obviously, you know, I wasn't even born when it was made. But, like, I remember being little, but I don't know how little I was or when they started putting it on TV every October. I don't even know.
Yeah. Maybe as, like, an addendum to this episode, we should have a conversation with our parents and sort of talk about, like, what was your judgment process showing scary movies to kids? Because I think I mentioned it before, and I looked up the dates recently, and they do sync up. When I was about 6 or 7, Nightmare on Elm Street 4 came out, and I couldn't explain. My only thought is that my parents rarely got babysitters.
Mm-hmm.
So when they wanted to go see the movies, we went together,
right.
And I was there as a little kid, like, willing myself to sleep during Nightmare on Elm Street, which thankfully I didn't know what it was, because I might have been even more frightening to think, like, I should enter the dreamscape as soon as I possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to go to sleep.
Right.
The point is, don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. My mom's funny, though, because, you know, whenever we talk to her on the show or I talk to her about the show, she's like, was that not normal? Was I a bad parent? Like, she always takes it, like, in a self-reflective way. I was like, no, you're awesome. We are on Twitter at Rance Macabre. You can follow us on Facebook as well there. You can send us an email. Our email is therancemacabre@gmail.com. And check out our website, therancemacabre.com, where we have extra things and stuff.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks. The Rance Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated.